Hey there, Kelly here. Guests on the show share so many great ideas, but how do you start putting them into practice? Well, that's exactly what you'll explore when you sign up for the Podcast Weekly Newsletter. Each week, you'll get 3 ideas from past guests sent straight to your inbox. You'll explore materials, techniques, tools, concepts, and mindsets in bite-sized pieces so that you can think about them and fold them into your own practice. It's completely free, and you get it by signing up at learntopaintpodcast.com/newsletter.
So I feel like the story of my process is just me trying to trick myself into obstacles and out of obstacles, just putting things in front of me that I'm going to have to figure out.
Hello and welcome to season 4 of the Learn to Paint podcast, the show that gives you the tools and ideas to help you design your own artistic path. I'm your host, Kelly Ann Powers. Today, I'm talking with artist Jessica Fields. In the conversation, you'll learn that you have more than just brushes when it comes to painting, how obstacles may help you create your best work, and a way to plan a painting around a specific color relationship. In the extended cut bonus conversation available over in the Podcast Art Club on Patreon, we talk pattern, edges, and the important lessons Fields learned from a 100-day project. For show notes and to sign up for the newsletter list, head to learntopaintpodcast.com/podcast/episode67. All right, here we go. Hi, Jessica. Welcome to the podcast. How did you get started in art?
Hi, Kelly. Thanks for asking and thanks for having me on. I am very lucky in that I got started very, very, very early. It was one of those things that I got praised for as a child and grew into, I think, you know, ended up going to art school. Ended up teaching art in high school, and then eventually started my professional career about 7 years ago, I want to say.
Well, then you just mentioned that you taught high school art. Did you have an art practice at the same time you were teaching art?
I did, but I was not selling anything for sure. It was doing lots of prep work for students, lots of examples and demos, and then trying to eke out my own thing on the side. And therefore, it very naturally became pretty sporadic and all over the place. Even though I work in college, even to now, I think there's a pretty straight line. The years where I was teaching, it was truly all over the place, which is something I loved. And I learned so much from teaching and from the students I worked with. But it wasn't until I took a break to have kids that I felt I was drowning in parenthood, you know, and I was like, okay, I need to hold on to something. Getting my art practice back was my priority. I had planned on going back to teaching when the kids were old enough, but before that could even happen, I knew I needed to start creating just for myself again. And honestly, having the structure of little ones, that nap routine and eating routine, is really how I crafted my art routines, finding the moments in between to paint on the kitchen table. So I didn't have a full-time job when I started working professionally. In fact, I sort of stumbled into working professionally. You know, I got my art practice down just for myself. That was something I needed. And then accumulated a body of work and felt confident enough to start out very small and just go to some local interior design shops that we have in town with some amazing artisans in their own right, and was able to do a few little pop-ups here and there. And then a local gallery saw my work in those pop-ups and reached out. So I was sort of hurtled into the professional field in that way, but really it started for myself just as a way to kind of reclaim that identity after motherhood.
Because you had gone to art school, was there any sort of adjusting of expectations in your own mind about what it meant to be an artist?
There was. I mean, I certainly don't think art school prepared me for all the different ways you could be an artist. Like, we visited galleries, and I went to Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design. So we were in Chicago a lot. We were in Milwaukee a lot, looking at very like urban spaces, urban galleries, very highbrow works, and not a lot of like, what's the word? Not a lot of variation from that. So I saw that as this one path. And even in college, I thought I would just go into teaching. Like, that's where I really thought my life would lead me. My mom worked in an elementary school. All of her friends were teachers. You know, it's kind of that generational thing. You do what you know. And I knew the school system. So I saw myself going back there. And then, of course, I did. I went and got my master's in art ed and started teaching. So I'm not sure that I ever expected to become a professional artist. Even, you know, with all of that privilege of going to art school and being exposed to all that, I still didn't see a place for myself in that world. It seemed a little too competitive, honestly. I'm like the least competitive person ever. So yeah, it's been a weird path to get here.
It sounds like you didn't go in intentionally to say like, I'm going to make a business out of art. You went in because you needed something that was yours.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great way to put it.
So then how did you approach it in those pockets of time? How did what you were making change in that time?
I went back to what I was comfortable with, which was landscapes. That's always been a happy place for me, a safe place, a place where I really just play with color a lot. So it was almost like I was picking up where I left off back in college, but with all the new information I had learned from studying different techniques, teaching different techniques in my teen career. And I taught art history as well. So obviously, you know, they say you don't know anything until you teach it. And I definitely felt that was true. I learned so much while teaching. So I had gained all this new information and was putting it back kind of where my thesis left off in college with these landscapes that were about shared places and memories and how things like that mingle. I don't know that I intentionally picked up where I left off. It was just where the materials led me when I got things out. It was very natural to just pick that up again.
So then we're going to transition to materials a little bit. So what medium do you use for your paintings?
They're all oil paint with cold wax.
We haven't talked about cold wax on the show. So could you just explain what cold wax is?
There's a bunch of different recipes and formulations that can go into it. It's like a sister of encaustic, but you're not painting it hot, obviously. It's cold. So it's this waxy, buttery substance that you're mixing into your pigments as you're painting. My recipe that I like to use is about 60% artist grade wax blended with just terpenoid. You can put Damar in there if you want that shine. There's some different resins, but I like just kind of the plainness of the twofer, the terpenoid and the wax. I like the matte finish that it leaves it with, and obviously the thickness that it gives my paint. I started it in college. I was asking a professor, I was obsessing over Nicholas de Stael back then, and he uses these gobs of paint. And I was just like, how does he do this? And my professor said, oh, that's like a lot of paint. And so I was like, I don't have that kind of money. That's so much paint. And then I was handed the artist's handbook with all the recipes in it and just experimented with a bunch of them until I found one that I liked. You can buy cold wax medium at the store, but it's much thinner. You can really paint with a brush with it. And I like to paint with a knife. So I like mine much, much thicker. So yeah, it gives me the thickness that I love. It gives me a matte finish, which actually a lot of people think my work is acrylic because of that. It's not, it's oil. But I like that kind of chalkiness. It does something interesting with the colors. It increases the dry time by a lot. It's like touch dry in like 4 days, which gives me a lot of, you know, I can start layering very quickly, which is what I like to do. And yeah, it looks like butter and you want to eat it. It's like icing. It's so amazing.
So do you like prep a bunch of the cold wax and then add it in when you're ready to start a painting?
Yeah, I collect jars like crazy. Friends bring me jars and I go to Costco specifically for jars and they're just all filled with wax because I can't figure out how to get wax out when I'm done. So then I just toss them and I feel bad about that. But yeah, I just have a jar of cold wax next to my palette and I'll scoop out a couple tablespoons whenever I'm about to start. And yeah, just slowly add it into each color that I'm mixing.
Okay, so you don't add it in until you're sort of like ready to use the color.
Yeah, because it'll start drying right away.
You mentioned that you use a palette knife. What does working with a palette knife give you?
That's an interesting way to put it. I've never thought about like what it gives me. I think it gives me an obstacle. I started it because I was getting too precious with my paintbrushes. I wanted all this control, but what I liked about painting was losing control. So I feel like the story of my process is just me trying to trick myself into obstacles and out of obstacles, just putting things in front of me that I'm going to have to figure out. And that's where these little weird magic moments happen. That's what I'm going for most of the time when those things happen. And 9 times out of 10, they're out of my control, but it's like I've set up this system of puzzles in order to lose control, and the palette knife is part of that.
It's so interesting hearing you say that because I feel like so often, especially when we're first getting started,
we sort of see lack of control as like, oh, I'm not good enough yet, or I'm lacking in some way. Like, real artists have control. And yet here you are saying that, like, no, that's a benefit.
I mean, I can't speak to everyone. Some people have wonderful control and it turns out beautifully. Just in my mind, that's not what I'm drawn to in my own work. I can pore over realistic paintings all day and love them. But when I feel a connection to my work, when I feel like this is me, this is the magic that's happening, it's always a collaboration between my intentions and the medium or the subject matter or the circumstances. It's that meeting in the middle that excites me.
Did you have to learn to trust that?
I'm constantly learning to trust that. Yeah, I'll go weeks and then just suddenly be like, oh, this isn't even what I like doing, and have to recenter myself for it. But I think most of the time, just parts of the painting process will bring me back to it. You know, like I'll be really into a couple finished pieces and be like, okay, I'm liking where this is going. And then halfway through the next piece that's being really difficult, something interesting will happen and unexpected. And then I'm like, oh no, this is the good stuff. It's that midway point before things are even ever finished. And then I kind of have to like refocus again and think, okay, well, maybe then I don't want my finished paintings to look so much like this. Maybe I need to focus more on this part of the process and see where that leads me.
With a palette knife, are there different kinds of strokes you can get with a palette knife?
Yeah, I think so. I'm pretty reliant on, like, I don't know any names of them, obviously, but just laying down the palette knife and pulling it down towards me. I would say 80% of the marks I'm making are kind of like that, especially in landscape work, because it's so horizontal. Even if I'm doing some mountains, it's like a little bit of an angle, but I'm always kind of just dragging the paint towards myself. And then if I'm doing a still life, say, and there's like a ginger jar that I'm trying to get all this detail out of, then I'm rotating the canvas and still just kind of slowly pulling that paint towards me. A lot of it has to do with how you load the palette knife, I would guess. I've never thought about it this way, but similar to how you want to get your paint on the brush, the way that you put the paint on the palette knife is pretty important into the kind of marks you want to be making. So if you're like only loading half of it, or if you're putting so much paint on it, then you're going to totally lose control. They're going to have very different marks.
Right. So does that mean like where you lay the palette knife down is a hard edge and then where you lift it up is a soft edge?
Yeah, absolutely.
Huh. Well, then looking at your work, you have some very pristine, hard-edged curves. How do you do that?
A very tiny palette knife, for one thing. I'd say the palette knife I use the most is, I think in the brand that I use, which is Italian, it's like a number 3. It's super tiny. And so that's the one that gives me the most control. And then also I will carve around as well. I use the tip of the palette knife as a drawing tool, and I'll carve excess paint off of a curved edge. So it might look like, you know, 5 different angled flat lines, and then I can kind of just swipe it and create that curve. So it's a bit of a cheat.
Right, because you're working with cold wax oil. So does that mean you like physically remove the paint?
Yeah. I use, man, it's my palette knife and it's baby wipes. Lots of baby wipes. I'm constantly removing paint and then wiping it off with a baby wipe. So it is a very subtractive process as well. And again, it, like you pointed out, it's because of that thickness. I can really kind of scoop things away as well.
How many different palette knives do you use in a painting?
I mean, really, that little one is doing 80% of the work. As I get bigger, I will use larger ones. And if I'm getting to like a 3 foot by 3 foot painting, which I know is not very big for a lot of people, but it's for me, I will use trowels or squeegees to get some really big strokes in. And that's super fun to play with those new toys. But for the most part, yeah, it's this tiny little palette knife that's doing a lot of the work. And then occasionally, I will use some store-bought cold wax, which I said is much looser, and I will use a brush.
What's your substrate?
For my tiny pieces, it's a canvas panel. And then for my larger works, it's canvas that is wrapped around a panel. I'm so redundant. I like to work on a panel because I love the hard surface because of the knife work. I don't want any bounce. That really kind of throws my game. So the small canvas panel, it's a built-in hard surface, but I don't like the stretchiness of a stretch canvas. So I will wrap canvas around a panel, paint, and then I'll take it off the panel and re-stretch it onto stretcher bars because it's like lighter to hang and cheaper to ship and stuff like that. I like the canvas texture though, so I'm not going to get rid of that. I've tried painting on just panel, but it's like my knife is just flying off the wood panel. It's got no grit to it. And I just like the texture of the canvas poking through, the weird grid under all your paintings, I think is kind of fascinating. So I'm not ready to let go of that yet.
Could you walk us through your process?
So still life work, I am working from life. So I'm setting up a still life first. Then I will stretch a canvas over panel. And then I clear gesso it like two or three times. I love the raw color of canvas, and the white kind of freaks me out. And I don't like the way my color bounces off of it as much. So it's a clear gesso. And then I will go over it in acrylic paints, very watery, almost watercolory, with kind of what I see as being the opposite colors of what I envision going with the still life. So if I'm looking at a bunch of green plants, I'm probably going to paint those red or purple, because so much of my work is about those color vibrations that happen when those layers come together. So it's an acrylic painting, very washy. I love to see some bleeding happening. And if that gets to come through in the final, great. If it doesn't, whatever, but I'll have it there. It's fun to play on top of. And then once that's done, I will do I mentioned drawing it first, right? I will draw it first and then do the painting. But then afterwards, I'll kind of go back in and draw again a little bit more technically this time, really getting where I want things to go. Whereas before, it was just kind of more like blobs of like plant here, lemon here. You get the idea. So after the technical drawing is more done, then I'll go in and start with the focal point. It's usually like a piece of fruit or something in the foreground. And I slowly work towards the background. And then honestly, doing the background is my favorite part, because it's just kind of like almost a color by number. And I get to find out what that final color is going to be in the background that's going to try to unify the whole thing. And a lot of times it works and sometimes it doesn't, but it's fun when you find something that's going to really make everything else pop. And you're not having to think too much about, you know, realistic rendering. You're just popping that color in wherever there's room. So that would be the final stage.
How does it differ for your landscapes?
So the landscapes, and I don't know why I do this. I'm just realizing this now. It's the reverse process. I still paint with the acrylics first, and I'm still thinking about complementary colors. I'm putting blues down where there's going to be an orange sky and vice versa. But then landscape paintings are all top down. I start with the sky, I come down to the mid ground, and then I finish with the foreground. I think that's just to create a little bit of depth, you know, even though my paintings are so flat and object-like, the little bit of layering that can happen on the edges to make sure the mountain is in front of a cloud, I think just kind of helps me with the idea of depth and making sure that overlapping is working.
Between both of those, like, how detailed is that drawing you're putting down? And are you using anything like a grid or a projector to help you get the accuracy?
With the landscapes, no, not at all. Landscapes are sometimes like three lines, like mountain and road and cloud, you know, and then I'm making the rest up as I go along. Still lives, obviously, a lot more drawing time. I have tried using a projector just when I want to play with scale, because I have a hard time drawing larger than life and keeping things in proportion. But for the most part, I'm just looking and drawing from life. And I like that I never get it quite right. I like kind of the lumpiness of my drawing sometimes. Obviously, my work is not supposed to be realistic. And so I kind of lean into that with the drawing, I think.
In that you're putting the ground of colors in, how detailed do you get with those, that first acrylic layer?
Not at all.
How many shapes?
I will probably do a highlight and a shadow, and they're usually pretty wild, like a turquoise and a yellow for an apple or something like that. They're insane, and they're very splotchy, so not a lot of detail with that first acrylic layer at all. Usually, let's say for like a 3 foot by 3 foot still life painting, that acrylic layer is done in half an hour. It's very slapdash.
How important is setting up a good still life for your process?
I mean, pretty important. I'm a big composition nerd. I love using like the 2/3 rule. And I don't know, maybe it was teaching high school for so long that I'm just like, it's ingrained in me. But I'll play around with the still life for longer than the acrylic painting takes me. I've got this huge shelf, all these fun objects I've collected throughout the years, mostly from my friend Jean, who runs a vintage shop. So very lucky on that front. I'm not digging for things too often. So just popping things in and out. Love it when I find a new sheet or tablecloth to paint on top of with a fun pattern on it. Once I get it set up, then it's moving myself around and figuring out what my favorite angle is going to be. And hopefully I can get like two or three paintings off of one still life. But I'm not so precious with it that I'm like sketching a bunch off of it first. I tend to get bored easily. So if I sketch it too much, then I'll lose some of the freshness that'll happen on the painting itself. I've got some viewfinders that I made out of like an old collage I did in college. It's so sad. I've had these poor little viewfinders for so long. I just cut some squares and rectangles out of one sheet of paper a long, long time ago. And I'm still using those to look through. So it's mostly viewfinder work and then getting started on the painting itself.
When you're doing that still life setup, are you thinking about shape or color or value? Like, what is the thinking that you're doing as you're playing around with that?
A lot of sizes. I'm always thinking about making sure I've got enough height in one area of the painting and that things are intersecting in an interesting way. Don't think about value very much. I'm fine with playing and making up the value and pretending there's a starker shadow than there actually is once I get going. So mostly the shapes are what I'm looking at. I love to find things with pattern on them. I got a little neurotic during COVID. COVID is actually when I started all of my still life work because I wasn't outside and landscape painting wasn't speaking to me then. That was not my situation. So I just started painting everything that was in my house, and like really losing myself in those patterns was an interesting way to kind of process all of the mania that was going on. You know, we were all just kind of losing our minds for a little bit, and I lost my mind in pattern. That's where my outlet was. So I still love pattern, always have, but that's where that came from in my still lives. So pattern, shape. And then I'm just really interested in the history of vessels too. I've been painting a lot of this Talavera, I'm not sure that I'm pronouncing it right, Mexican pottery. And I've been painting this ginger jar that was my grandmother's for a long time, and kind of understanding the history of how all those things informed each other, with the ginger jars coming into Europe and informing like Wedgwood and his blue and white ceramics, and then the Europeans bringing it over to Mexico and setting up shops there, and the indigenous patterns being brought into it, and all of it in this kind of funky blue and white, and then when color would come in and when color would leave. So I like juxtaposing those in my still lives and kind of letting them talk to each other still. I'm not saying anything with it. I just like history. So that's a little bit of where some of that stuff comes from.
Well, then, is it important for you to have something like a strong light set up? Like, how important is the lighting for your still life?
I make that up a lot. Sometimes I've got like one lamp in my studio that does look at my still life table, and sometimes it's on and sometimes it's off. I'm usually pretty good about imagining a light source left or right, and then just kind of figuring out where the shadows would go and enhancing that or not, depending on what the composition needs, if it needs a strong shadow on the ground or not. Again, because my work is so flat, I'm not super concerned with the value and a strong light source. I just want it to be consistent so it's not adding confusion.
You make up, well, you don't totally make up, but you, like, there is some flexibility with the values.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you, like, when you're looking at a reference and then working on the painting?
Yeah, I'll completely change colors on things. A red blanket will become blue if it's necessary. I will grow a vase. That's what I was talking about when I was talking about using the projector occasionally. Like, I really need something that's this big, but I only have this size. So I'm just going to like grow it on my computer and make it enormous, even though it's not, because my brain won't do that when I'm drawing, but I can kind of enlarge it with technology. So I'm happy to play with those sorts of things.
How much do you have planned before you start? Let's say, like, if you're going to change a green blanket to a red, do you sort of have that planned before you start painting? Or is that a decision you'll realize in the middle of a painting?
Probably both. Sometimes it's, oh, I think this would look good better with this color backdrop, so I'm going to change the color of this blanket. And then a lot of times it's in the middle of a painting going like, oh, I've got this literal orange sitting in front of an orange vase. Why wasn't I thinking about that? They're going to clash and blend in. I'm going to change this to a different color. So sometimes it's informed by what's going on in the painting, and sometimes it's a intentional decision before the painting gets started. If it is an intentional decision before the painting gets started, it's usually because I'm super drawn to a color combo that I want to play with, but I don't have the objects to play around with. So That's usually why I would do something like that. But a lot of things change once a painting gets started. Once a painting gets started, man, I feel like I am passenger seat at best, if not a backseat driver.
Did you have to learn how to do that in the sense of like, nope, I'm a passenger and that's just how it is? Did you fight that at all?
Yeah, I definitely had to learn to let go quite a bit, especially when it came to the still life work, because that was an attempt to gain control and then let go of control again. But I feel like that's my whole process, is me getting greedy with control and then finding ways to let go again. So for as long back as I can remember, that's always been part of my process, is trying to let go and let the painting do what it wants to do. But I am constantly relearning it at the same time.
Are you sort of like, I guess, working wet into wet?
Yeah, I work wet into wet a lot. I typically work on one painting at a time, so I'm not giving it a lot of time to dry. And I love to, like, let's say I finished a lemon. I'm liking it. It looks like a good little lemon. And then I'm painting the blue vase that's behind it. And I love those reflections that happen. Like, then once I'm focused on the blue vase, I'm seeing how all of that blue is informing the shadow on the lemon. And I get excited about that. And I'll just use that blue I'm using on the vase on the lemon. And I get that streaky quality because it's trying to dry. It's a fast dryer with that cold wax, but I can lay down some blue on top of it. And it's like a nice blue smudge on that green. And that gets really exciting.
After the whole painting is, I guess, dry, like a couple days later, do you come in and do a different layer?
Sometimes, sometimes not. It just depends on what the painting needs. Not often, though. I don't plan on it. I love to be done. I love to be just walk away. Doesn't happen often. There's usually somewhere that needs a little something, but I am really trying to get it at a couple goes.
How do you decide how much detail or not detail to put into your work?
I don't know that it's too much of a conscious decision each time. Definitely try to put more detail into the focal points, but I usually don't want to break anything into more than like 4 or 5 planes. With the palette knife, I'm often thinking about even the roundest of objects as very planar and angular. So just kind of breaking it down into the geometric shapes that I see, forming it so that I can get those hard edges with the knife to kind of hint at curvature. Yeah, I just looking at the light on the object, I try to get shadow, midtone, and highlight and go from there. And then less and less with the objects that are not in the focal point.
And then it might be totally different with your landscapes.
Not too different. I'm looking at a couple of mountain pieces I'm doing right now. And it's breaking the more complicated areas into smaller and smaller shapes where I want your eye to be drawn. And then leaving the rest almost to evaporate into is that still part of the landscape? Where did that shape come from? You know, like kind of that dispersal of interest of just boom, you get what's going on here. And then you're confused by the time you get to this over here. But because I've hopefully given you something to hang on to in the beginning, you can still enjoy it as a landscape. Or you can get into the weirdness of this 80s dance party that's happening in the sky. So it's just trying to give someone something to hang on to, I think.
And it sounds like, though, you're really thinking about shapes.
Yes. Yeah. Shapes and color. Love them.
Well, then, thinking about color, what has been the most challenging part of color for you as an artist?
Subtle colors. Once I get into the neutrals, I get very in my head about things getting muddy, and they scare me. I freak out. I'm like, I'm in mud again. And I go back to my bright yellows and oranges, and I'm like, okay, this purple can be a stand-in for brown. I'm not going to try to make brown. So subtlety is definitely something I want to work on. What I do when I'm starting a new painting a lot of times is I'll just have like one post-it note with some ideas for that painting. Like on this one, big sky. On this one, green and orange. Try to make those colors work together. And I swear like half of these post-its floating around my studio just say, try dull colors. Try subtle colors. I've got all these artists that I love that I printed out little just like thumbnails of their artwork tacked all over to like remind me that can be beautiful. Look at how cool it is. And it's just one of those things that I'm on a journey struggling towards.
I love what you said about the post-it notes, because sometimes as beginner artists, we think that if and when we finally reach a certain skill, then we'll just know where we are at every point in the painting. But it sounds like you sort of create a North Star for yourself to help remind you of where your goal is.
Yeah, yeah. And 90% of the time, I forget. And sometimes I get too far down a road to even get back to that post-it goal And then it becomes the goal for the next painting. Again, this is why subtle colors are like written on post-its all over the place, because I have yet to achieve it. And that's part of that push-pull of letting the painting take control, is that once I let the painting take control, sometimes my post-its go out the window. This painting isn't here for that, and it's going to teach you something different. And you can try that again if you want to later. So you're just along for the ride.
Right. It's interesting hearing you talk, thinking about like the different parts where like you go in with an intention and then at some point you shift to understand like, nope, I'm a passenger and this is where it's going.
Yeah.
How do you know when that's the painting telling you you need to go in a direction, or you just getting distracted by something, or is it the same and it doesn't matter?
No, I think it does matter. And I think that's one of the hardest things about my process, at least. What is my gut and what is taking you towards some sort of truth, and what is, you know, like, and then these are like big terms to throw out there when I'm really just talking about whether I should use orange, pink. But for me, I'm always trying to find something that feels magical. And there's a lot of color combinations that I find very safe, where I can get a little bit of magic, but I know it's there. I know how to make it happen. It's in my tool belt and I can pull it out anytime. And sometimes it is the answer. So is that comfort that I should follow, or should I be doing something else? It's always a tension for me. I have so many paintings that end up with just yellow fields at the bottom of them. I cannot count. I've even named several of them yellow fields one, yellow fields two, because it's just such an easy solution for me. But, you know, obviously don't always want to take the easy solution. You're trying to find new ways to solve these problems, and finding which voice is louder and which one is going to move your work forward is super hard.
How do you create a space in your studio that allows you to be sort of connected with your gut?
I've tried several different things. I've tried having a place just for collage, or just for sketching, or just a place where I can play a lot and not feel so precious with my materials. I have failed almost every time I've tried to do that, because I can make anything precious. I have this large painting I was working on that didn't work, and I painted over it again and again, and it just didn't work. And finally, I took it off the panel I had it stretched on, and I ripped it up. And you know how canvas in those beautiful straight lines? Well, then I fell in love with some of the scraps. I started repainting on those too. I was like not able to give up. One, because I'm super cheap and I hate throwing things away. And another way, like I'm cheap with my time too. Like all of my time is so precious that I hate to have wasted it on something. I'm horrible with the sunk cost fallacy. Like if I've put poured effort into something, I want something in return. So while I do try to create these literal spaces to like listen to my gut, I think what ends up working the most over time is just having that steady studio practice of I'm going to come in and I'm going to paint every day, no matter how much other stuff I have to do, packaging and shipping and emails, and my kids got an astronomy project to do tomorrow, which is true and is stressing me out right now. I am going to paint for a little bit of time. And I'm even going to try to get like one painting done a day, which is why I love those 5x7s and 4x4s, because I know that putting in that time is what's going to connect me to my gut. That's what's going to center me on the larger paintings, if that makes sense.
Do you think of yourself as a daily painter? Like in the like start and finish a painting every day?
No, I don't. That's always the goal though, but I don't think I live up to it. I think for the most part, I get in here and I paint every day. And a lot of times I do finish a little one at least. I get distracted so often though. But it's that intention of trying to get in and paint every day that keeps me focused.
One thing I feel like artists don't talk about much, but I feel like all of them experience, is just time anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
For you, the daily painting, but not necessarily being a daily painter, that helps you manage some of that time anxiety. Are there other things you do that help you sort of keep that in check?
No, that's the big one for sure. It's funny you mentioned that, because I get in a fight with my husband about this all the time. He's a computer programmer, and I'm like, but you know what you're doing every day. Like you're going to go in, you're going to like write this code and it might not work, but then it's so much more logical. And I feel like in my job, my work, I don't know what's going to happen every day. And so to try to plan for a show or like plan anything just feels wild to me. And so, yeah, just committing to myself that I'm going to come in and paint every day is the only thing I can do.
Right, because you know it will happen. You don't know how long it will take to happen.
Yeah, I have to rip it up into little shreds.
For you, do you work with a limited palette, or how many colors are you generally working with in your palettes?
Let me see. I'm going to turn around. I'm looking at about 15, I think.
Okay. Do you generally work with paint straight from the tube, or how much mixing do you do?
Almost always some mixing. Maybe if I need a super bright yellow, that could come straight out of the tube, but very rarely. Always a little bit of mixing. That's really where I have my fun, is mixing those colors together.
How do you plan the color in your pieces? And actually, does that differ between the still lifes and the landscapes?
The still lifes, sometimes I will intentionally change the colors, but for the most part, they're informed by the objects themselves. So the fun part there is in collecting the objects and being like, ooh, that's going to be a fun color to paint. Like, I just got this awesome rooster vase that's mostly yellow, and it's a good size too. He's nice and tall. And there's this fun kind of Polish folksy rooster painting on it. So you get that like painting within a painting in it too, which I'm a big fan of. So yeah, that's more like shopping. You know, it's finding the fun things to paint and then letting those colors inform your painting. With landscapes, and I think these inform each other. The landscapes are almost usually completely made up when it comes to the color. The compositions are usually from photographs that I've taken or friends have taken. I used to work plein air. I do not have time for that anymore. So it's all photographs. And they're very, very sketchy. Like, the drawings are a couple of lines. And it's really just brainstorming compositions is when I'm looking at the photographs. That's what I'm doing, is just like, oh, that'd be interesting if the mountains went back like that, or if the road twisted like this, or God forbid there's a tree. I'm so bad at trees. That's another thing that's on a lot of post-it notes, is be better at trees. But what I was getting at was the color is really where the invention happens on the landscapes. I will start out with like a pairing usually. Like, I want to work with a periwinkle and an pale orange and see where that takes me. And just starting off with that pairing, usually with where the sky touches the ground, I find very interesting. The rest of the painting grows that color relationship. It's not super planned out. It's just what looks good with this and what looks good with that. And then having to back up and be like, okay, well, what's working with the whole picture? And then get back in there, and what's working with relationships? And then what's working with the big picture? So totally invented.
How much in your landscapes do you use stuff like atmospheric perspective to move people's eye back in space?
I will use diagonals, not call them perspective. They're definitely, I use them to lead the eye around, and they do have kind of a distance quality to them, but usually they're not even really super attached to a road or a structure. It's just like a brush stroke. But the depth, again, comes from that overlapping of paint, of starting with the sky and going down to the foreground. And then maybe slightly, and again, not great at this, but like duller colors in the background versus the more intense colors in the foreground.
Well, then, do you generally, when you're layering, do you work dark to light in an area?
No, it's pretty random. And the way I lay my colors down, again, because I've got that acrylic layer that's doing a lot of the work for me. If I can get away with just one swipe of color on top of that acrylic, that's what I love. I feel like that has more breathing room in it than when I end up layering a bunch of colors over top of each other, which I think every painting needs. It needs those heavier parts, but I try to reserve that for just areas that need more weight. So there's not a lot of density happening. There's not a lot of layering in order to create darker colors. If I'm going for a darker color, I'm mixing a darker color and slapping it on there.
How does saturation play into your work?
All of it, all the time. I'm such a maximalist when it comes to color. I want all the saturation. I want all the intensity. I want the super brightness all the time. So I think it's when I have to step back from saturation that is more intentional than the saturation itself. Like, I'm mixing all these super bright colors and then occasionally need to go back and be like, okay, if I paint this gray over this purple, that might help this area out a little bit. Like, they can't all be screaming at the same time.
Well, yeah, along those same lines, your paintings have so much shape and so much color, and yet they're not overwhelming. They're just like beautifully colorful. How do you keep it from being overwhelming?
I mean, it is a lot of restraint on my part, because that's not what my brain wants to do. My natural inclination is bright colors all the time. So a lot of it is, I like to do like as much as I can in one swipe, you know, one go, and try to get it all done. And then it sits on my wall for 2 weeks. And I'm like, okay, I've come to terms with the fact that, you know what, that whole middle ground area cannot be as bright as the rest of this painting. And then I'll go and tone that down a little bit. So a lot of the work I do wet on dry is actually trying to create more subtle areas. The rest can sing more. Because obviously, if it's all going all the time, you don't get to enjoy those moments. And so to let different parts of the painting really glow, I'll go back in and try to calm some areas down.
But it almost sounds like you've created space in your process to be really excited about saturated color and not have to worry about toning things down. And then you've also created a place in your process where you can focus on that. But it sounds like you don't ask yourself to do both of those at the same time.
That's a great way of putting it. Thank you. I don't do that on purpose, but yes, I have created multiple spaces. that's fascinating. I have never thought about it that way, but I think I do. Oh my gosh, how can we ever like not let ourselves be excited in the beginning stages? That's like the best part. I don't know about you, but the first quarter of a painting is where it's at. After I'm done with that, then it's a little bit of a chore. Then you know where it's going and you're like, okay, I'm going to finish this, but I want to get to the next painting so I can start that next quarter of a painting. So yeah, keeping that excitement alive is what I live for. And then the figuring out of the painting as a whole and making it all work is the chess part.
Well, then when you say that you like to like finish a painting, do you have several on your wall that you're thinking about at a time?
Yeah, it's a lot of get them going, get it all covered, and then put it on the wall and forget about it for a little bit and start the next one. And then just as you're in the studio and you're taking breaks and you're on your phone and you're staring at that painting and wondering why it doesn't work, that's when it starts to talk to you and you start to realize, oh my gosh, why didn't I see that that needs to be an angle there? That's why that feels so heavy on this side, and you can go back and fix it.
If someone came to you and said, I want to get really good at painting, what advice do you give them?
To paint every day. Even if it's just for 5 minutes. And I think almost anyone could really find success with that kind of commitment. But it is hard. It's so hard. I don't work out every day. I know I should. I just read a whole book about how I should, and I don't, and I can't find the time. But I think it's the secret to everything, finding time for things that you prioritize.
You can learn more about Jessica Fields at her website, www.fieldart.work, and on Instagram, and we'll link to everything in the show notes. Thank you so much for being with us today, Jessica.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Everyone has a great time meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me for this first episode of Season 4. But wait, there's so much more good conversation with Jessica Fields at patreon.com/learntopaintpodcast. Sign up at any tier and you'll get immediate access to over 20 bonus conversations with past guests. It's easy to sign up, cancel at any time, no hassle, and all for the monthly price of a fancy coffee. For show notes, head to learntopaintpodcast.com/podcast/episode67. Thank you to everyone over in the Podcast Art Club. Extra shiny thank yous to High Gloss supporters, Andrew Atterbury, Debbie and Brian Miller, Rihanna DeRold, Janet Wheeler, Nancy Bryant, Catherine Ordway, Pam Lyle, and Victoria Young. Happy painting!